Hello, everybody. How are you doing? This is S. Anthony Thomas. This is the S. Anthony Thomas Show. And my guest this week is an old friend of mine, a comic by the name of Mary Frances Connolly. We started out roughly the same time in Philly back in the mid-80s. This is a great episode. You're going to love this. Not only do we find out some interesting things about her, but we literally trade stories of our worst gigs ever. And I mean worst ever. Trust me, worst ever. You're going to love it. In addition to that, we talk about what it was like for her to be a comic back in the mid-80s. We talk about the comedy boom, and we talk about why she actually started doing comedy, and it's not what you think. It's not what you think. So, folks, are you ready? I am. You are too? Cool. Let's do it.
Hello?
Well, hello to you.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well, Mary Fran. How are you doing?
I'm excellent.
Well, you have just entered, you know where. You have just entered your friend's show, the S. Anthony Thomas Show. How are you doing?
I am doing so good, and I'm so excited to be doing your show.
Got you fooled. Well, everybody, this is Mary Frances Connolly, a friend of mine for a long period of time. We haven't seen each other in a while.
In a long
time. That's what
happened. I see you on Facebook, so yeah. I feel like I see you all the time.
That's the funny thing, is just that it's one of those weird things where normally you'd run around and you'd try to make sure that you move things to see people that you know and that you love and that you like and that you enjoy and all those kind of things. But Facebook keeps you just attached enough.
Yeah. It
keeps you just attached enough, you know, because it's really weird because everybody listening, this is my friend Mary Frances Connolly, very funny comic. I've known her for, I think we've known each other 715 years.
It's at least 715. Yes.
How long? 715 years.
How long have you been doing stand-up?
I started in January 8th, 1986.
So I was a year older than you. I was April 23rd, 1985. It was my anniversary.
And it's an interesting thing because we both started in what people call what part of the comedy boom was that? We're in the middle of the comedy boom.
Oh, the heart. It was the heart of it was amazing.
And it's hard to explain to people just how many clubs there actually were. I shouldn't say clubs, places that had comics talk to drunk people.
I used to say that Wanamaker's was going to start having us in the dressing rooms.
You know what? That's the only place we didn't play.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, I worked at a bowling alley. I mean, everywhere.
You know what's funny?
What?
You're going to reference the places that you worked, and you and I both know I was probably there the week after you were there. Because we both started out in the Philadelphia area. You know what's really cool, though, is I see a lot of comics, not a lady comics, now finally getting some of the shine that they didn't get when we started.
Yes. When I started,
you know, they
it was just Chris Rich, Tracy Skeen, and me. We were the only three women.
And it was, because I felt bad about that, because obviously at 17, it was nothing I could do about it. But,
yeah.
You know, it was just so weird. I'm sitting there going, why is this so difficult?
Yeah.
I mean, I always thought every time you picked up the mic and you went on stage, you took care of business.
Right. Thank you.
So, if someone goes on stage and kills regularly, what's the problem?
Problem is attitude in the audience. They think that women aren't funny. That's how it was.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, for those of you listening, in the 80s, the things that people are getting canceled for now, you know, like the ridiculously over-the-top dismissal of ladies, that it's good that you can't get away with it now, and I'm glad about that.
But back then, I mean, I literally remember being on a show, and I apologize for my language to you and to the audience when I say this, where a lady's on the stage, she's doing a great show, and everything's going fine. And then they say, show us your, and, you know, refer to
your tatas,
the chest area.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I had it done.
And I'm like, they got you. How many? They probably gave it to you. They probably gave it to you like 8,000 times.
Yep. All the time. Routine. I used to say that when Anita Hill had the hearing, the Clarence Thomas hearings, I was like, that's all they said to her. It was like so mild compared to the kinds of stuff that myself and other women had to face. It was awful. Mm-hmm. You were always
and
kind.
Of, I don't know.
You were always.
Yeah, kind. I mean, I was. I don't want to brag, everybody, but I was woke.
You were woke. You were woke. We didn't know what woke was, but you were woke.
I was woke at 17, so I'm just trying to say that.
It's your generation. That's why I date younger guys, because of their attitude. That was exactly why.
That's why you dated younger guys. You really?
I still do. I mean, I used to be a cougar, but now I'm so old, I'm a saber tooth.
I'm just trying to say, I'm trying to get you to admit in front of these people that is not the only reason you date younger guys.
No, it's not the only reason. They look good. I mean, dear God, I'm not an idiot. I am shallow.
Now, this is something that's really weird, because I've had some friends on the show before, and like I had Big Daddy Graham on the show earlier in my first series of interviews. Yeah. And I've known him virtually the same amount of time that I knew you, but, and I thought I knew everything about the guy, and I did know 85%. But what I didn't know, and I was always curious about this, because when you do what we do, it takes something to push some. Listen, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have my finances and my life dictated on me coming up with ideas, writing them down, memorizing them, and then standing on the stage in front of a bunch of people and having them judge them. And that's how I'm going to make my living.
It's a little crazy.
You know, I just want to do that. So I know what made me go up there, but what made you, what is the Mary Fran origin story?
The MF origin story is very simple. I got into show business to get off welfare.
You know, that's going to be a short movie.
I had a wonderful, and still do, have a wonderful daughter. And we were very poor. It was just the two of us. Her dad was not involved by his choice. And I knew I needed to make a living, and I needed to make a man's wage to support a family. And I thought, I knew I was funny. I knew I could make guys laugh, because I used to, on the way to Cardinal O'Hara High School, at the back of the bus, I would sit doing Bill Cosby albums, imitating Bill Cosby albums for all my friends, and the guys loved it. So I knew I was funny. So it was either that, or learn something like refrigeration repair, which you could do through the state. So it was one or the other. And I saw that comedy was the coming thing, and that's what made me do it. I did not do it out of love. A lot of comics do it because they just have to be on stage. That's not me. I'm a comedy slut. I got into it for money.
Yes, I have to admit, have you ever seen that movie Fame with Coke, where the guy makes Coco take her shirt off?
No, I actually never saw it.
It's like an exploit. It's like, go ahead, Coco. Take your shirt off. That's what you feel like in comedy, when you go on stage.
Oh,
you know, and I don't want to laugh at that scene because it was a dramatic scene, but it's such a tough thing to do.
Yes, it is. I was so scared. I didn't know that comics actually enjoyed stand up. I thought it was as torturous for all of them as it was for me. And oh man, I think it was about 4 months of going twice a week to do open mics before I actually had a good time on stage. And it used to, because what comics say to one another before they go on, we don't say break a leg. We say have fun. And I thought that was ridiculous. It was the opposite of what I was feeling. I was terrified.
What I would say to the audience is, if for those of you, I don't know whatever country, it doesn't matter what country you're listening into, and it doesn't matter if you're in Indian, whatever. If you pick up that microphone, just realize the first year of stand-up comedy is very similar to the first 21 days of working out if you've never worked out.
That's really smart. That is very well said.
Thank you. I mean, because it's like people will lie to you. I remember when I saw, you remember the movie Punchline?
Yes, vividly.
Okay. Now, do you remember how Sally Field was on stage bombing and then Tom Hanks waved his finger as if to go keep going and then all of a sudden she started killing? It does not work that way, everybody.
That movie was a fantasy. That was a Disney story.
I went to see that movie with a mutual friend who's no longer with us. Fred Novak.
Oh, I remember Fred.
And we were the only two comics in the building. And during the dramatic scene where Tom Hanks is crying because his father's in the audience, we're hearing everyone, oh, yes. They're all sympathetic. Fred and I are literally laughing hysterically. We're sitting there going, we're professional comics. We've had beer bottles thrown at us. And he's crying because his dad showed up. Oh.
There's no tears. There's no crying in comedy.
It was just really weird. But that first year is so tough. And I think that when you move to different cities, and this is something I want to find out, because you played a lot of different places in a lot of different states and things of that nature. I want to see if you agree with this, if you have the same experience. I started out at the Comedy Works in Philadelphia, which is more of a white-collar club. I went over to the Comedy Factory Outlet, which is down the street, which is more of a blue-collar club. And they literally, you had about 12 seconds.
That's Philly.
You know, to prove to them that you were funny or they were going to destroy you.
You have your skin removed. It's Philadelphia. It's the toughest audience, but it's the best.
Right.
It creates comic.
And so when you go, and when you go anyplace else, it's easy.
Yeah. Except, now let me tell you where it wasn't. Sometimes for me, being an Irish girl from Philadelphia, in Philly, I cut up guys. I make fun of guys because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. But when I would leave here and do that, the audience could be a little bit afraid of me. And I had to learn to tone it down a little bit. But the Philadelphia audience is the best training ground for stand-up comedy.
I think that's the thing. That's another thing that I didn't think was actually fair to the comics who were ladies, is that, you know, a guy could just lace into anybody. And the moment you moved out of what they considered the box you're supposed to be in because you're a lady, sometimes in some places they kind of sit back a little bit. And then you'd have to bring them back again. It was like spinning plates on the Ed Sullivan show.
It really was. Not so much in Philly. In Philly, I feel a freedom that I don't feel anywhere else. But even Baltimore, which is so close by, Charm City is very close by. But I can remember working at Fells Point at a club, and I'm like in the midst of my set, because in the beginning of my set, I used to talk to the audience for about 10 minutes, and. Ooh, they were scared. I mean, they were literally pulling back a little bit. And I was like, okay, I've got to tone this down.
That is just one of the weirdest things. So you started it out of necessity.
Yes, I totally.
Now, was there a part that, because we're both three decades and change in now. At what point, I mean, did you ever get that? Because you said that you didn't start out on love, you started out on necessity. And because, I mean, essentially, you knew you had the talent, you know, and you decided to apply it, even though the specific vocation wasn't what you wanted. But was there a part where you started to go, you know what, I actually do like
this? Yes, very much so. First of all, it's really cool being able to do something that very few people can do and many, many people want to do. So there's that ego portion. Yeah, most definitely. And I came out from the theater. That was my background. I had been at Hedgerow Theater, which is a semi-professional troupe. Now it may be professional in the Philadelphia suburbs. And so I had years of experience performing. I had a singing coach from when I was 11. And my first performance at Hedgerow, I was 16. And I was stage manager at 16. So I had a lot of experience behind me. So I shouldn't just say I took the stage as a stand-up comic cold. I didn't. I did have years of performing experience before I got up there at the age of 35. Half my.
Let's not gloss over the stage manager at 16.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was another education that was utterly incredible. It was amazing.
How did this come about? Most people don't, most of the time you don't have the word manager and 16 in the same sentences, unless there was like, don't let the 16-year-old be the manager.
I looked a lot older. I looked 10 years older than I was. I've never looked my age. So it's nice now I look 10 years younger than I look 10 years older. So I've always been very lucky with that, with my map, as we call it, the Irish, your face is your map. And I was close to this guy who was a director of, I was involved with the Glass Menagerie, and he was like my best buddy. And he was like in his 30s. He had been in the movie The Blob. He played the sheriff. He and Steve McQueen started out at the same time in show business in the film The Blob, which was shot in Downingtown and Phoenixville, two Philadelphia suburbs. Mm-hmm. And he made me the stage manager and the understudy for Laura, the young female lead in the play. And I did pretty well at it. I really loved it. And I was very serious and got the job done. And then I was stage manager for a French play by Jean-Paul Sartre, The Balcony. I know this is not normally what comedians talk about, Jean-Paul Sartre, but that was my back.
this one yeah, does, but go ahead.
Well, that's another Philly thing, and people are pretty well read when they're from the Philadelphia audience. I swear, is brighter. That's another thing. I'd like to know why it's just such a different experience. They catch the subtlest lines. It's fascinating, and it doesn't matter whether it's a working class, a middle class, whatever, you know, country club audience. There's a similarity. It's fascinating. Did you found that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the times what I noticed was there was a, and people, I don't think people get this, but you know, you have a blue collar, they think that you don't have intellectual exactly. curiosity, which is ridiculous. Not the case, you know, and you know, because you'll see people when people saw the book, because I didn't attend college, right? But when people see the books that I have, they go,
yeah, same
what?
Here. They're always like, did you actually read all those? And I'm like, yeah, and 10 times that, you know, yeah. That's my
thing. Yeah, you know. Well, the thing I've noticed also is that part of the job that we have is we have to know things, you know, because we're essentially, you know, we're kind of like the idea equivalent of a food processor. you know. You know, because we have to know so much to put in the ingredients to push that button in our brain called "I'm a comedian," and then create this gumbo. And it's that's why I always thought I was really fortunate to start here. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in New Jersey now, but I'm down in Philly. But I'll say here anyway, because in this mental experiment that we're having right now, I'm in Philadelphia. So so for the mental experiment, I'm in Philadelphia. But it's because I met a lot of good people. I mean, we had a good group of people, talented, and surprisingly
very
supportive.
Very, very generous.
It's great. because I went to a few other areas. I'm not going to name them, mainly because I have listeners in those specific areas. So those areas are incredible. And in fact, everyone in those specific cities are very good looking and talented and brilliant people. I'm sucking up to the crowd. But when you would go to a different city, when you go to a different city, I'll just say on the west side of the country. And I would go places and good Lord, the first half of the week, they're looking at, look at this guy from Philadelphia. Look at him. By Friday, hey, buddy, you know, I'm going, can't you just be nice when I get here? We never did that to anybody that came with the Philly jersey. We thought you were funny. We were funny. We were nice to you. We didn't care.
It was a collegial atmosphere. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Which means we got drunk. Which means we like to get you drunk and throw you in the water.
Listening to Ted, what was his name?
As we put mashed potatoes in our mouths and punch our cheeks like John Belushi. When you come.
Man, we had a lot of fun. Oh, it was so great.
It was kind of cool. What I really got a kick out of was the bars, the bar gigs, and those really weird gigs where, you know, they would pay you in cash. And I just want to say for the record, when Mary and Fran and I would play these particular bars, they did pay in cash, but every bit of taxes was paid
every single
one of those gigs.
Some of those gigs. Some of those bars. Oh man. And my brother was a priest, and he was always a wreck that I would get beaten up. And I'd say, first of all, they're not that stupid to throw a punch at me, because God knows what I would do to them. But he was always like, but you say things on stage they may not agree with. But I never had a problem. Well, now.
People don't understand this. You don't want to just like try to beat somebody from Philadelphia up. That's really not a good idea. This is what I got to ask you. This is good, because we started, we played a lot of the same places in a lot of the same areas, especially since we started roughly around the same time. I know you got to. Can you remember? After all these years, everybody tends to have at least 2 to 5 hell gigs that are burned into their cerebellum.
All I had to hear was you saying hell, and I'm thinking Stone Balloon, Newark, Delaware. I was doing stand-up maybe 8 months, 10 months. And
oh, God, no.
It was a 3-man show. I was to be the MC. I was making $75, which was a lot of money at that at that level.
That's
and
a ton of
the MC. The middle did not show up. He just didn't show up. So it was me and the headliner. Now the show is to be 90 minutes long. If I bail, that means that comic has to fill in the 30 minutes that the middle isn't there. Because generally, so your listeners know, the way it works, the MC does 20, the middle does 30. And the closer does roughly 45 or so. And it equals out to around 90 minutes. I know that isn't 90, but whatever. Bear with me. So I had to do my time, and preferably into, you know, as far past 30 as I could go. And I certainly had 30 minutes of material at that point. The audience started screaming, chanting. The 300 people in the audience started chanting, "Get the F off the stage." And I just reached into my pocket. I had been paid up front, which I normally don't like to do because I'm very superstitious. And I just kept touching the money and kept going on. And I did 35 minutes so that the closing act wouldn't have to fill all that time. And I came off the stage and no one would look at me in the audience. They just wouldn't look at me. They knew what they had done was horrible. And it was like a bunch of Nazis is how it felt like. Like, this is what it feels like to be at Nuremberg is all I could think of was this chanting audience, you know, 300 yes. against one. It was awful. And then I went back about 6 months later and I did very well because I had to go back. I couldn't just never go back.
Oh, every place you that kicked to. Me in the groin, I went right back and smoked that place a few times in a row. Yeah. it was one of those things where I'll get to my health story in a second. It's like when you watch, it's like I remember in high school, yeah. there were these guys that were way bigger than me, and one tried to beat me up all the time. And I ran into him as a 35-year-old man, and now he's like 2 inches taller than me. And he walks up to me, and he looks guilty as heck. And I'm going, and he goes, "Oh, hey, man." I shook his hand. I was like, "Dude, that was 20 years ago." You know, like, it's okay. We were good. And he goes, "Sorry," and he hugged me. And I'm like, "I'm so sorry." I said once again, "Dude, it was 20 years ago. Don't worry about it." Yeah. And because you know. Wow. but that thing right there, that it's hard to explain because it's very similar to when wrestling finally admitted that it was
yes
sports entertainment. You know, so back in the day when the person was a bad guy in wrestling, people hated them in real life, not realizing it was an act. When you go on stage, it's almost like the moment you step on stage, you're this thing that resembles a human. But isn't one, and then you step off stage. And we're like, "Oh, yeah, we were yelling at that thing that looked like a human." Oh.
Tell me your hell gig story.
Oh, I was doing a gig in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We pull into the place; they're already stomping each other in the parking lot. They're fighting in the parking lot. We go into the club. The guy, there are people, you know, there's a couple having sex on the pool table in the back.
Mother of God. Oh.
I mean, they're we're looking like, no one's going to stop this. No, leave him alone. Because he knew not to mess with him because he was the group that guy was with. Was part of the group of people that was outside stomping each other in the parking lot. So he didn't want to do anything. Like, he's like, "That's out there. We're in here. Don't worry about it." We go on stage. My MC, she starts to do her act. A bag of ice flies up and bounces off her forehead. She runs off the stage, and I'm like, "Look, man, you know, he goes, listen, if you guys don't do the show, you don't get paid." And she goes, just do it so we can get out of here. And I'm like, I'll cut this down. That was bull, you know. She said, "No, just do it." My feature goes on stage. 5 minutes in, he gets hit in the head with a bag of ice. So they've done 10 minutes. I go on stage. Now, because they had run off the stage, they had broken the microphone. So the only microphone left is the one in the DJ booth.
Worst story I've ever heard.
So I'm leaning my back to the DJ booth. The DJ booth looks at me like, "You still doing it?" And I'm like, "Hey, yeah." He hands me the microphone, the microphone goes about, 7 or 8 inches outside of the DJ booth. I have to introduce myself because, well, I have the mic now and the DJ can't do it. I said, "All right, I'm about to do this thing here." One of the guys in the audience walks up stage with a knife in his hand, and he said, "F those other two, you better be funny."
Oh.
Here's the kicker. Hour and 20 minutes, it goes well. An hour and 20 minutes of leaning into the DJ booth, and for some and for some reason, they're lapping it up.
Yeah, of course.
They're lapping it up, but I don't trust it because all I need is one bad bit.
Yeah.
And And it's you know what? I'll take the ice. I just don't want the guy with the, you know, that switchblade that you, you know, it's like, you know, like one of those old switchblades. You expect him to, it was like those, you know, the one that you spin and it flips out. Like, you know, I was waiting for him to go, when you're a jet, you're a jet all the way. I was waiting for that. Yeah, it's like West Side. And we just kind of walked down and they're like, clapping like nothing happened. They, like it was a regular show. Yo, you're good, Holmes. I'm like, yeah, all right. The other two people are at the door, like in the running position. I grab the money from the booker and he goes, I'm leaving too. So we all run out, get into our cars and literally out of the parking lot.
Tell you one more. Bristol, PA. Bristol, PA, a motorcycle bar.
Oh, God. Bristol.
Before I get there, the announcer says, and we've got a woman comic coming, and she's going to light her tatas on fire. So now I get there, and I'm in a great mood. I'm ready to work. I've left. Now, understand, I'm a priest sister. I've got a beautiful little daughter at home who's like 5 years old. Sweet little thing. And my mother is like almost 80 in a nursing home. And she's going to and I'm going to light my tatas on fire. Well, when I was told this, I didn't want to go on, but of course I had to in order to get paid. But I was so angry. And the audience, they didn't say or do anything, but they also didn't laugh. But I was in a vile humor. Just, I was really, really mad, as you can imagine. And a comic I know worked there.
Ooh.
And he said that, I don't know if it was the manager or someone said, Lizzie over there wants you to have sex with her in the back room. he didn't do it.
Jesus Christ.
Like, he was terrified. He was like, oh, mother of Jesus. You know, there would be a walking disease. It was a very motorcycle bar in Bristol.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. See, as you know, I've also played Bristol. And you know, I was surprised at how many motorcycle bars that we all actually played. And what surprised me the most was how in some cases I did a show with a friend of Chuck Carmen. We drove out to a gig in one of Chuck's cars and Chuck's cars back then. Okay. And it's not, I'm not talking out of school. Chuck knows his car sucked back then. His car, I had to go into the passenger's, the driver's side. Cause the driver's side, cause the passenger side door was held closed with a metal, he had to roll down the back one. We took a metal hanger and stretched it out and tied the door closed. So that's, and it's just like, and it's a, oh, and no. It's a, it's a Philly winter. So, I think, you know, it's about 19 degrees outside when the car is not moving. Okay. It was 19 degrees when you're standing there and we pull up to the gig and I'm sitting there going, are we going to die? Because these are the directions they gave us. I'm not seeing anything. And literally, we turn right. It's a cornfield. It's a cornfield pitch. And I said, Chucky, look, you drive 15 minutes. If we don't see a building, spin it around. Spin the car around. Because it's like, last thing we need to do is like, two dumb bastards were trapped in the, got caught in the cornfield. What and then all of a sudden you see this light, and I'm sitting there. I said, "This is like a little bit too weirdly spiritual here, dude."
Yes.
And it turns out the BFW hall behind the cornfield, and I'm like, "Oh my!" I said, "You know what? This is scary as hell, but let's just walk in." I mean, what difference? I mean, if they're going to kill us, they're going to do it anyway in the back of a cornfield. Yeah. Open it up. There's 400 people in there. Yeah. The door opens. It's like that. We step in, they look back. The comics are here, yeah!
Of course, 400 people in a cornfield.
And the show was fantastic.
That you were a celebrity. You guys were celebrities.
That is, you know what's really weird is when you go, and I'm pretty sure this is, Pennsylvania is, I think Ohio is probably the same way, is like, when you get outside of the coast of, that's why the states are very similar to the makeup of the country. Right. 90% of the people on the coast and a little bit people spread out in this big area in the middle. If you leave Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or if you leave the big cities in those states and you get to the middle of it, it's like, you're from a big city? Oh, that must be great then.
Yeah.
Or you stink. You're from a big city. You suck. You get one of the two and you never know. I don't mind if I get you stink if I'm a small town somewhere, but it looks kind of like a city. So you can like get the hell out of it. When you're behind a cornfield.
It'll make you into a human scarecrow. It's frightening.
I'm curious. I was like, I do not want people going, he was a very good man. He was a kind man. All we have left of him is his shoe and a microphone. Yeah. That's all we have to remember him by, is that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I don't want to be on Law and Order. It was a comic. You know, not very like that.
Very funny comic, but they never
you know, in the criminal justice system. Yeah. Oh, because and that's the funny thing about it too, and that's why when we go back to being a female comic, is it's even more perilous, I guess, in that particular situation.
If
you're a lady driving by yourself in these particular places,
go ahead, see what'll happen to you.
You kind of had to, yeah. I mean, because it's a tough city just in general. But the good part about it is it makes you tough.
They let you alone.
And also, once they realize you're tough,
they
just sit back. Oh, cool! And they just sit back, you know, and they love the crap out of you. And they leave, and it was beautiful. Now, what do you consider your home club back in the day?
Back in the day, now it's the Comedy Cabaret in Doylestown is where I work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, once the pandemic is over, we'll be back there. But I guess it was the Comedy Works and all the Comedy Cabaret.
So, mine was the Comedy Fact. We were down there. We were across the street from each other, essentially. You know, but we all played both. And regarding that Doylestown Comedy Club was above what, Poco's, it was.
It's great.
Love
that place.
Still there? I got some of the best tapes I've ever gotten.
Right.
I put the tape in the back of that room. You know, when you walk in, there's the door, and to the left of the door, there was like the sound booth or whatever, the sound board right there. And I mounted my camera above that. And I got, I don't know how many thousands of dollars of shows I got off of those tapes because I kept using them.
Suburban clubs are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Did you make those trips to? Because a lot of Philly comics, we kind of realized that you could do what you needed to do because the area is so big, South Jersey, Baltimore, Washington, Virginia. Go to the west as far maybe Lancaster. You go to you have South Jersey. Actually, say Central Jersey. There's got to be like 15, 17 million people in that area. So you can make a living right there. But did you ever get the feeling, did you ever go up to New York?
And you not make any money.
That was the reason, you know, we're so close by.
It all came down to supporting my family. So that, I think I worked New York twice because there was no money. And I mean, if you got paid, it was $25. And it was like, nope. Not doing
it.
And you
couldn't
work Boston. Boston was closed. Boston only hired Boston comics. But other than that, I basically worked Did you work Boston?
I will not listen to these lies. No. No. A friend of mine, he goes, dude, don't even go up there. He says, if you go up there and you're going to stay up there for a couple of years, fine. But if you're just going up there, don't waste your time. I said, you serious? I said, and at first I'm thinking, yeah. I'm going, well, this guy, I like this right. guy, and he's never lied to me. I don't think he's one of those guys that would, you know, say, don't go up there because I'm keeping all the gigs to myself. He never did that. So I'm going, he must be telling the truth. And that's a bit of a hike to start all right. over again.
And what do you get out of it?
And it's not immediate, and it's not New York or Los Angeles. Essentially, you're just, that's like a person who's a weather person going from Philadelphia to Baltimore. It's like, just stay in Philadelphia. It's a top 10 market.
Yeah.
It's not New York or Los Angeles. It's a lateral move.
I would do Hartford maybe 3 times a year. I worked basically Hartford to Richmond. Oh, trust me. If I live,
they will pay you though. So,
I don't leave my house for under $100. And he laughed. And I said, I'm not being funny. You know, I needed to get paid to do the funny.
Yeah, I told the person, I remember, this was the first time I started, closing clubs. Obviously this is 16 million years ago. And I called this gig, and you know, when you work a lot,
right,
after a while, you don't really have to audition or send tapes because they've heard your name so many times. Yeah. And sometimes they'll just call you and they can, look, I heard of you. Give me the, you have a March 15th to 16th. I called the guy. He had heard of me. I don't know why I didn't know this, because I was stupid back then. I call him up, and I'm about to give him the old, you know, you go to a car dealership and you're about to give them the business. I'm buying this car for $25,000 and that's it. So I call this guy, I'm about to give this guy the business right. guy. And I had a number in my mind that I wanted.
Wow.
The number he offered was twice that number. And I was trying my best.
Right.
To not young 20-something me to let him know that his number was stupid. You know, because I wanted 200.
Oh, that's amazing. And you don't want to appear.
He says, impressed. I can only pay you 4. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, that's the good thing. See, kids. Because I have a third of my audience is young kids. You don't understand. See, back then there weren't cell phones or video cameras or video chatting. Because if there was, I might not have gotten the $400 because he would have seen the look on my face. And he would have seen me jump up and click my heels like in a Toyota commercial. You know, that was the weirdest thing. Now I want to ask you, Mary Fran, is when you went the blog,
yes, the boomennial,
the blog that you have.
I am a millennial trapped inside a boomer's body.
The boomennial. And that is where we get, because I was reading your blog when you told me about it, and I started this. I saw something it brought up memories, because you were talking about world famous radio broadcaster.
Well, I can never forget Howard Stern.
Howard Stern.
That blog post.
And you could never forgive Howard Stern. And I think that it reminds you, because you were talking, you tell them, because it's better coming from you, obviously.
Harassment that female comics had to go through in those days. And I could tell you almost to the night when his program became syndicated in Philly, because the guys in the audience became that much more hostile, and because of his attitude. So that's basically it in a nutshell. And I talk about the kinds of things that we had to go through We Women Comics. And I said that he's kind of the, he reminded me of George Wallace. You know, he apologizes and has changed, but it's like it doesn't undo the years of hostility that I went through. And it affected my dating life because I was mad at men. Because at work, I would be treated so badly by so many of them that it was kind of difficult to date. But thankfully, that is no longer the case.
That is weird. You know, it's amazing to me. Like when you see, I'm not going to dive deep into politics, but when you see how people take the certain level of treatment and they kind of hold on to it until they get to a specific group.
That is exactly what it's like.
And then they release the venom.
With it because we're not going to beat them up. Like if they were to talk to a man like that, they'd get beaten up. But they're bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I was wondering about that, because I still remember, it's amazing how you get so desensitized to things, and when you were talking about how it's starting and some of I'm literally now just sitting there remembering some of the things, some of the jokes and the bits that were done on stage. That at the time you just didn't think they were that big of a deal. And then as you get older, as soon as you become older, you start to experience more, you start to meet more people. And then you remember, obviously, I was too young and I didn't write any of that crap as a kid. You know, but, and also as I was very, very woke at 17. And, but I remember, because when I go back and I remember some of the jokes and I look at and I remember some of the bits and some of the people that said some of the bits, and there's a part of it that goes, "Oh, ooh."
Yeah, I would stand. I would stand at the back of the room.
I mean, just imagine someone.
Like, man, I gotta go up there.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Stuff. It's still going on. There's still a lot of unwoke material, shall we say? They'll call it cut. You know, they think it's edgy, and it's like, oh, so you think it's edgy to put me down? Yeah. That's your idea of edgy? I talk about death on stage. That's edgy. That's not easy. It's a lot easier to make fun of women or sex or being married or whatever than it is to get up and do some of the stuff I talk about. But they're edgy. Edgy.
That's the thing. I mean, it's one of those things where the people that are actually edgy are edgy people.
Absolutely.
And a lot of times I would see people that, you know what I mean? I mean, and so when they would actually be edgy, that's when you get the people that know how to hit the topic. They hit the topic with a scalpel and not a grenade.
So good. And it's been a lot written about it this whole week.
Goodness. Yeah, my people were DMing me on Twitter. I was like, I saw it. And there were some people that were just I got people that were hitting me with DMs,
really?
And my direct messages on Twitter that were like really long,
well.
Like, and F him.
Oh, no, I thought he was.
He hates women.
Just
he sucks.
And take talking to? Oh, I thought that was
and I'm going,
so
I said,
wonderful.
Yeah, it's like, because the thing is, if you hit a topic that's tough with a scalpel, you know, people, a lot of times people don't see what you're doing right away. You know, they don't pick up on it. Because nowadays everybody...
I mean,
there's plenty of things to be outraged by.
What he said is not. I mean, there's so much to be outraged by. But he said stuff that made you think. That's exciting.
And I know some people. Yeah, some people I saw that were like
really?
Like big time comics, were like really super mad.
Do you follow Rich Scheidner?
Super mad. Yeah. And I was like, on Facebook,
his writing.
Yes. Oh, Rich, I saw you on Facebook. I saw you. The thing is, I didn't think that Canyon Man. I knew that he would. He's an old pro though, you know. I mean, and also he comes from that era. Also, if you really think about it, just imagine when the comics that from our era would hang out at a diner or a bar, and
yes,
people that don't do comedy don't know what it's like when comics who like each other are talking. See, like we're talking now on this show, and there's going to be a bunch of people that hear this. But the conversation we're having now is not the same conversation we would have.
I was just going to say a diner.
If you, me, and a couple of other friends were sitting at a diner.
There's a freedom again.
And no one was listening to it. You know?
Freedom?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, they would not.
What is that Seinfeld?
You know, you're not attacking anybody, but you're just talking freely.
There's a wonderful Seinfeld movie. I can't think what it's called. It's a kind of a documentary. Oh man, that really.
Oh, I have it. I bought it. It's called Comedian.
Mm.
That I literally watched that thing.
Oh, it's just that's
I've
us.
Seen it
that's our
well
lives.
Over a couple hundred, well over 200 times already.
Yeah,
I bought the DVD. Did you? I saw it's on Netflix now. If anybody wants to see it, but the thing is,
I'd like to see
it doesn't have it doesn't have the backup commentary with Colin Quinn. Yeah, with Colin Quinn
really?
And
Jerry
Seinfeld are doing a second. They have a second track with commentary
I'll
on it.
On my Christmas list,
and
that
it makes
awesome.
That movie. Oh my God! Get the DVD. You got to get it. Oh my good! If it still exists, because nobody's selling DVDs anymore. But it's like, it takes a movie that you already like and the insight and the inside jokes and the things that they're having conversation underneath. And I'm going, and then when you watch the movie again without it, just like, I still love this movie, but I need to have access to that. it's like if you go to a restaurant and you get the best cake in the world and you're like, they give you a couple scoops of ice cream. This is fantastic. And you go back and you're going, we don't sell it. We don't have ice cream anymore. What? I need the ice cream, damn it. That's what it's like. You know. Now this is another thing I saw. And I saw you did a piece on your blog
dating is horrible.
70.
It combines two awful things. It's like an interview with condoms.
Yeah.
Congratulations. When is your birthday?
I turned 52 this month.
Mine was the 9th. I just turned 70 on Saturday. Friday.
The 27th of this month.
Yeah, it's cool.
I
like getting older. I have so much
happy
freedom.
Slightly after your birthday to you as well.
No one tells you this, that it's that getting older is cool. I can sleep when I want. I don't have to go to some stupid day job I hate. I always say basically I'm a 15-year-old boy with her own apartment and no adult to harass me.
Oh, my God.
It's awesome. I do.
Okay, I'm going to have to call the child services.
I write poetry.
And,
it's amazing.
I'm pretty sure something's...
I had no idea that this was in store for me.
Now hold it a second. I'm not moving off this dating thing because you were talking about dating apps.
They're horrible.
Dating
apps. I tried to go out
horror
with a couple
story.
Guys my own age, but I'm always afraid that they're going to like collapse right in front of me because they're so old. I don't want to have to take care of some old ass.
Yes.
Oh,
now, how young do you go? Now that's what I. That's because you outed yourself.
I don't want to be ridiculous.
You.
So you do get on these sites, you get like guys that are like 30 hitting on you. And it's like, no, what is wrong with you? Why are you doing this? And one guy was writing to me, said, well, I have mommy issues, but that's that. I'm like, no. But I mean, some of these guys, I'm old enough to be their grandmother. Yes. And it's like, I didn't know that that was out there. And that's a little too much for me.
How quickly did you hit this? Isn't there one a dating app where you
swipe on,
or maybe that, is that
Tinder
a functionality of all in where you swipe, maybe you
left.
Swipe up or right to get rid of the person,
swipe
or
right bar. Bumble was created by the ex girlfriend.
What was the other one? Tinder and what was the other one?
Tinder and Bumble sucks. There's Bumble, a lot of both of them I don't like because there's a lot of scammers on there. Guys, they claim they work on oil rigs or they're in the army and they can't meet you. They're engineers and I'm going to be at sea soon, so I won't be able to see you. And then about 2 months later, they'll ask you for an Amazon gift card because they can't buy what they need to get and get me that and blah, blah, blah. That's a huge thing. But Bumble, their selling point is that it's in the woman's hands. It's just a gimmick. It's just a gimmick. And you know, it's like a lot of these guys, they just text you and you never meet them.
The thing I find astounding about that whole situation is they're saying they can't meet, they can't do this, they can't do that. I'm going, you're holding a phone with a camera on it.
But they don't.
This is not 1979. You literally have it's a phone with a high definition camera where you can do click, click, and you can be talking directly to each other. And I want to see some ship. I want to see a ship behind you or some airplanes. if you're in the army. I better not see a damn Chevron station with a Chevron shirt on. And there's nothing wrong with that, but just admit it.
They're 17-year-olds in Nigeria pretending to be 60-year-olds that work on an oil rig. It's amazing. I mean, it's an entire industry. It's a $1 billion industry, the scammers. It's amazing. Yeah, they do.
They have to hit so many people. And if you just keep drilling away, even if you hit that magic, and then everybody knows that the conversion rate is usually 1% for everything. You get 1% of the people. Amazon gift card. You don't want to do that? I'll send you cash.
When I first started on these dating things, it was actually on Instagram that I would answer someone. Going? And one guy said that his son was in California and had his little daughter, who's 5, just had to go in the emergency room and his medical insurance card wasn't working. Could I give him $500? And I mean, I wouldn't give $500 to my daughter. No, that's true. I would give her $500. But ridiculous. It's just amazing. And I was so naive. I was like, But I knew immediately when he asked me for money that this was fake. Yep.
I'm sitting there going,
$500.
So he literally went straight to $500. I mean, I used to work it was a company that worked for PBS. And we would call people who were viewers of PBS, and they said they had a thing called first ask, second ask, third ask, fourth ask. The fourth ask was like $100, but they started out at 15, and worked up to 100.
Now these scammers.
You can't just call up. Hi, I'm calling from PBS. Give me $100 now.
And what they do is they love bomb you. Have you heard of love bombing? They love bomb you, and they say all these things that they think you want to hear. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
I get a really big kick out of watching people who get scammers get caught.
I do too.
I find that fascinating, and I love it. I love it, and I love it all.
Yeah.
Now, I want to the last thing I wanted to touch on with you is I planned on asking you about this earlier, but we got into some good stuff there. So this is what I wanted to get to actually near the beginning. Ugh. Instead of at the end here. COVID-19 and comedy.
I last worked on March 7th. I haven't worked since then.
Exactly. And it has blasted everybody. But what I've seen is, and I wanted to ask you about this, is I saw comics. And I got asked to do a couple of these things, but it's like, you know, I got a couple podcasts. But
I can't imagine that. Zoom shows. How does that even work?
Thank you for. See, people have been saying to me, come on, man, you got to do Zoom shows, man. You got to do them. And to me, I'm going, do you want me to stand in my office with a microphone in my hand?
There's no way.
In front of my laptop and tell jokes to six, seven squares on the screen?
I mean, I'm seeing some of these clubs do it outdoors, and even that would be difficult, but it's work.
You know,
you can feel the audience. You can sense what they're, and you can see their faces. I always have to see the faces of the people. Yeah.
I'm seeing some of the places kind of open back up a little bit, like
Helium is and Soul
in Philly. Like I think Helium is doing some stuff outside. Is it Helium? Yeah, Helium.
But I was talking
doing some stuff out.
Yeah,
I've never been there though.
I was talking to the owner of the Comedy Cabaret where I work. And he was saying that how it is here.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Once the state of Pennsylvania allows bars to open, then they'll open up again. Yes, because it'll probably be socially distant. I don't know how that'll work.
That is going to be really weird, though. You know? I'm just wondering, not to be weird or anything, but it's like, listen, I'm going to watch some of my colleagues go out there and test the waters. And then I'll slide back in there because I had planned on starting to do stand up regularly again, and literally, the new plague showed up, and just blocked everything for the past 7-8 months. I'm going, I'm sitting there going, I got this new material. Oh, this is gonna be great. Can't wait to work this material out. Everybody, stay home. Don't touch anything. Recycle air in your own mouth. Point.
Yeah. The whole thing.
Isn't that weird?
The best is when you laugh at it. You're like, when you
go look at stuff you wrote and you're going, oh yeah. Do you ever feel, I felt like an idiot. I found an old tape of a couple of sets I did back in the 80s. And I'm looking at this child that looks like me. Right? You know, and some clothes I would not wear if someone had a gun on me. Put this shirt on. Nah, just shoot me, bro. No. I'm not putting that shirt on again. I'd rather die, bro. And I'm watching him. He was pretty good. And but I'm looking at these jokes and I'm going, I know I wrote them, but they're 30 years old. So that's, you know, so
it's
that's
just weird.
And then every once in a while, like out of an hour, I went, I remember that one.
My entire career.
That one I remember.
Catholics were taught. Let me see if I can remember. See, I told you I don't remember my own act. We're taught never to have Catholics were taught never to have sex until after the first baby. That's been in my act for 35 years. 35 years, but that's the only There's one I wish I could bring back. It was like a woman's true religion.
I remember it.
Food.
I remember
it. She meditates and she says, yum. Now that's from 35 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't. They're horrible.
Isn't it weird? When you go back and look at your old jokes and you're going, I can't do it. I can't. Literally, there's a box, there's a big box right next to my desk, right? It's like a big box of jokes from over the decades. I won't open that box. you could put gold bars in that box and I wouldn't know about it.
You can't even believe.
Because I'm not looking at that stuff. Look, it's like,
as you say, the clothes I wore, the hair I had. I had 80s big blonde hair. I am not looking at that stuff. And oh man, I look back at these. I have videos, and occasionally, maybe every 20 years, I'll look at the videos, and it's just, who is that woman? Yes.
Well, guess what? I don't need their videos because I remember you with the hairspray hair.
Oh man.
I was actually there. I remember the hair that everybody had back then. Unfortunately, I was swift enough to have close cut hair.
Genuinely funny, so, and you just,
that's like, the only thing that's not embarrassing about the old tapes is my haircuts.
Like, how was I that deluded? What? I would not.
You know,
like,
it'd be great.
No,
as if you wore one of my old shirts and I had that haircut. Now, that would be good.
I don't know how I got that big. It was just so big.
Well, you know, it's half a can of hairspray. It's like everybody else. Yeah, it was just like everything else. It was a half can of hairspray.
Well, that was fun.
Well, Mary Fran, we have come to the conclusion of this glorious episode. I am glad I got you. I am glad I got you on here. Now, what I want you to do me a favor. Now, I have your websites and things of that nature, your blog, your Facebook, and your Instagram. So I'm going to put them in the show notes.
Oh, no, I can't.
For everybody.
I don't have any
but
gigs
if there's anything you want to say to the audience, this
so
would be the time.
Let
them know where you're going
to
be, what you're going to do.
BOOMENNIAL, theboomennial.com.
Yeah.
And every 2 weeks I publish something new. And on Instagram, I have some fashion and some poetry and links to my blog.
And folks, like I said, Mary Fran stuff will be in the show notes. So no matter what player you're going to listen to this show just scroll down into the show notes, and I'll have the links to all of her websites there. Okay, Mary Fran, thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
It was
so
great
much.
Talking
Thanks
to you.
For inviting me.
I love catching up with old friends, especially people I love and dig and think are hilarious.
Good. Thank you so much.
And thank you for coming. We'll harass each other on Facebook. But All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Now, that was fun. I told you. Huh? Have I failed you yet? No. Will I fail you? Absolutely not. And I'll be honest with you. I have other stories of gigs that absolutely sucked. And I will tell you about those on later episodes when it's just me talking to you. Thank you guys very, very much for listening. Thank you for all the new listeners and the new countries listening. Thank you. Much love to all of you. And I will see you again next time. Much love to you. Take care.